This is I Choose Life News and Views, sponsored by Indiana Right to Life and Right to Life of Northeast Indiana, committed to defending innocent human life for all people of all ages. Your hosts are Kathy Humbarger, Abigail Lorenzen, and Scott Kump.
Welcome to I Choose Life News and Views. I'm Kathy Humbarger.
I'm Abigail Lorenzen.
And I'm Scott Kump. I Choose Life News and Views is produced by Bot Radio Network in Fort Wayne in cooperation with Indiana Right to Life as well as Right to Life of Northeast Indiana.
And now, the pro-life news.
Here are excerpts from a live-action news story. Fears about dwindling personal protective equipment and containing the spread of the coronavirus has led certain states to suspend abortion services. The Associated Press recently interviewed staffers from abortion businesses that have not halted abortions. These staffers claim that due to distress over economic and health concerns, more women are seeking abortions now than they normally would. Julie Burkhardt oversees several abortion facilities in Wichita, Kansas, and Oklahoma City. And according to her, the calls her facilities have received have been frantic. She implied that there have been huge uptakes in the amount of procedures being committed due to women's fears about not having access to abortion. Later in the interview, Burkhardt revealed that her Wichita facility, the same one that recently sent a woman to the hospital, committed 252 abortions this past March, up from 90 last year. Conversely, Texas Public Radio stated that Planned Parenthood of Greater Texas had canceled 261 abortions already by March 24th. Amy Hagstrom Miller, president and CEO of Whole Women's Health and Whole Women's Health Alliance, also stated that her facilities, quote, had been forced to cancel more than 150 appointments as of March 25th, end quote. In a time when women need medical resources, providers such as Planned Parenthood have suspended all services with the exception of abortion. The need for prenatal care and other forms of support does not seem to be receiving as much attention from abortion advocacy groups. Instead, the focus seems to be on how COVID-19 has pushed more women towards an abortion decision. As pro-choice groups continue to argue that abortion is an essential healthcare procedure, over 30,000 medical professionals have dismissed this idea. They come from organizations such as the American Association of Pro-Life Obstetricians and Gynecologists, known as APLOG, the American College of Pediatricians, the Christian Medical and Dental Associations, the Catholic Medical Association, and the Association of American Physicians and Surgeons. APLOG has called the continued practice of elective abortions during an outbreak medically irresponsible and has aptly pointed out that, quote, elective abortion treats no disease process, end quote. To read the entire story, go to liveaction.org and click on Latest News.
This is Kathy Humbarger. I haven't been with you for a while, but it is indeed my pleasure to spend a little time with you today to unpack the whole coronavirus COVID-19 situation and talk a little bit about how this impacts the issue of life and protecting unborn boys and girls and their mothers. To that end, we have a very special guest today, Attorney General Curtis Hill. Thank you so much, General Hill, for joining us again today. You're getting to be a regular with us.
Well, thank you, Kathy. Thanks for having me.
Well, for those who don't know much about you, you're the 43rd Attorney General in the state of Indiana, formerly prosecuting attorney for Elkhart County, and you were elected in 2016, and I love this statistic, with more votes than any other elected official in state history. That's quite an accomplishment.
Well, it was certainly a lot of fun at the time, and it's not bragging if it's true, as they say, but I'm very grateful to the level of support that we've experienced throughout the state of Indiana. And it demonstrates that folks in Indiana have a good sense of what they want in their leadership. So I'm very proud and pleased about that.
Thank you so much for your service and my experience in pro-life advocacy over a number of years, General Hill, certainly proves you to be the most aggressive attorney general regarding defending pro-life legislation passed by the Indiana General Assembly and signed into law by the governor in our state's history. So once again, thank you for considering this not a side issue, but a very important foundational issue for government. So we appreciate the fact that you do take a close look at the legislation that is passed and then challenged in court and act accordingly. I just found out yesterday, General Hill, that Senate Bill 299 that passed this past legislative session and was signed into law by the governor, the ACLU surprisingly announced yesterday that they're not going to challenge that in court. That is truly amazing. I can't remember the last time the legislators passed a law that was not immediately challenged in court.
It does make you one a little suspect of what we left out of if we're not getting a challenge on that.
Well, I should point out that Senate Bill 299 was actually the directive to the Indiana State Department of Health for how to enforce the legislation that you did fight all the way up to the Supreme Court for the respectful disposal of unborn boys and girls. So you fought that fight. You just didn't have to fight it twice, it looks like.
Well, I think all humor aside, what it really lines up with is what we've been talking about all along. The actions of Dr. Klopfer were so extreme, so out of the ordinary, that even those who support and promote abortion found the actions to be incomprehensible. So hopefully that's a sign that we can find some common ground in this particular battle.
Absolutely. Well, lots is going on right now, not only in Indiana, but across the country with the COVID-19 crisis. Just in general, have you ever seen anything like this before in your life?
No. And hopefully, you know, we all hope and pray that we don't see anything like it going forward after we're able to successfully navigate it. The massive assault on our way of life, our liberties, you name it, it has been unprecedented, and it's the subject of futuristic movies. And now we're living this rather rapidly changing, evolving process of lockdowns and shutdowns and limitations. We're not used to that in this country. I think one of the really big problems, aside from the horrific circumstances of illness and death that's occurring all over the nation and, in fact, all over the world, but this concept of what's essential and what's not essential and who gets to pick, and that's contrary to at least most of our sensibilities as Americans in terms of the freedoms that we enjoy. We don't want government selecting where we go, what we do, how we do it, who we associate with. These are very, very uncomfortable circumstances, and while we can tolerate some of this during a time of emergency, I think you're seeing signs all over the country, and certainly in the state of Indiana, where people are going to require greater information to continue down this path of restricting freedom.
Well, one thing that surprised me is how easily or how quickly we've been willing to accept encroachments on our rights. And I understand that there's a legitimate concern here with the COVID-19 crisis, but it's a little scary to see how easily everybody just follows along. When I was an elementary age student, the big thing was the polio epidemic back in the 50s. And I can vaguely remember that, but I don't remember. I mean, people voluntarily decided what they were going to do and where they were going to go. But this is a way beyond that. So hopefully this will come to a quick end. I read somewhere yesterday where a pundit said, choosing when to open up everything is like choosing between a heart attack and cancer. So I think that's a pretty good way of looking at how these two very important issues, safety and freedom, are in tension right now.
Right. And they shouldn't be mutually exclusive. I mean, it shouldn't be one or the other. We have to find a way to have balance. We want to be able to exercise as much precaution as we can without engaging in hysteria and fear and panic that erodes our public confidence.
Absolutely. Well, let's turn to how this whole COVID-19 virus has impacted the life issue. As always, you were one of the attorneys general leading the nation to make certain unborn boys and girls and their mothers are not lost in the shuffle, and you did that in more than one way. But let's start with the Texas ruling. As I understand it, on March 22nd, Governor Greg Abbott, a very passionate pro-life elected official, barred medical procedures that are not immediately medically necessary And then the Attorney General of Texas, Ken Paxton, quickly said that the order applies to abortions. Now, best I can tell, this has gone back and forth in the courts. And I know you filed an amicus brief in support of the state, along with some other attorneys general. How did this end up in court in the first place? And what's the current situation?
Well, we joined the amicus brief to support Texas along with, I believe, 13 other states. And the way this case ended up in court is the way that it usually does. Abortion groups that typically stop at nothing to ensure that abortions continue no matter what the circumstances jumped into the fray. As a result, Texas took a strong position that said that abortions were elected procedures, and it went into the court. As I understand it, down in the Fifth Circuit, that the court kind of gave Texas governor a bit of a win, but not a complete win, by saying that abortions, chemical abortions, were still okay to continue with, but did put a halt to surgical abortions for now, under the rationale that surgical abortions required PPEs or personal protective equipment, and therefore, given the nature of the emergency and the need for that equipment, it was appropriate to suspend those elective surgeries.
A couple of follow-up questions before we move on to the next issue. For those who are listening who, like me, don't have a very in-depth understanding of the legal process, what is an amicus brief, and do you think they're effective at all?
Amicus brief is literally a friend of the court. It's a group that typically has an interest in a particular action and that the court would recognize, and filing that brief provides aid or assistance to the court. At least when it's offered, that's what's being hoped. And it certainly has been a very useful tool, having spoken to a number of judicial officers, including Supreme Court justices and appellate court justices, both at the federal and state levels. They do provide very meaningful assistance to decision makers, judges, and in courtrooms on how to ferret through sometimes very, very nuanced issues. So it's something that we have used on a number of occasions, continue to use. We have led several, and they oftentimes, our amicus work is cited in the official opinions that are reached in cases that we're not even party to.
Well, the clock is running in Texas as well as across the country, and I think this order expires sometime later on in April. So in a practical way, the decision may be made anyway, if everything's opened up, and then it will be business as usual for the abortion industry. But in some cases that go all the way up to the Supreme Court, while the issue that prompted the case has been resolved just because time has resolved it, will the Supreme Court possibly still hear this? It would seem to me that it would be an important point to clarify by the Supreme Court, just in general, if an abortion is essential or non-essential. Do you anticipate this moving on, or will it be dropped once everything gets back to normal?
I doubt that it will move on beyond the end of the emergency period or the circumstances. Typically, the Supreme Court doesn't engage in advisory positions or opinions. They deal with the issue at hand. And so if the issue resolves itself before the court has, or even in many cases where the court may have the case under consideration, it's my experience that they would not necessarily engage in a decision at that point.
This is Kathy Humbarger. You're listening to I Choose Life News and Views. Our guest is Indiana Attorney General Curtis Hill, and we're talking about the impact of the COVID-19 virus crisis on the life issue and how things are being played out in court, questions and issues, and the clarity or lack of clarity. So, General Hill, there was a lack of clarity about where Indiana was in terms of, is abortion essential or non-essential, and has the governor ruled on or made it clear what the position is? So 72 legislators back in March sent a letter to Governor Eric Holcomb asking for clarification, because there really wasn't anything, I don't think, prior to that, that had been said about abortion procedures being urgent or non-urgent. And to his credit, the governor then included abortion in a subsequent executive order banning elective procedures, sort of. The executive order says to preserve PPE for healthcare providers who are battling the COVID-19 pandemic beginning April 1st, 2020. All healthcare providers, whether hospitals, ambulatory surgical centers, dental facilities, plastic surgery centers, dermatology offices, and abortions, are directed to cancel or postpone elective and non-urgent surgical or invasive procedures. So we were very happy with the governor's statement. However, the next sentence says, an elective and non-urgent procedure which can be delayed without undue risk to the current or future health of the patient as determined by the patient's treating physician, dentist, or other healthcare provider. And while this sentence sounds like there will be a consultation between the doctor, the abortionist in this case, and the patient who wants an abortion to really determine if it's essential or not, a few years ago when we were doing an investigation on some abortionists, I actually heard them in a hearing brag about who could be the quickest to get a woman in and out of the abortion operation room. And they were talking about less than 5 minutes. So it seems to me that that is really a short amount of time to determine whether it's essential or not. And we know that Planned Parenthood, the going rate for abortions in Indiana, is somewhere over $800. Do you think there's a bit of a conflict of interest here?
Well, I certainly think that it's unquestioned that those who perform abortions have a different standard in terms of what's necessary and what's a medical necessity, and those who think the abortion should be prohibited. And I think that's the crux of it here. As you pointed out, the original executive order did not specifically address the issue of abortion clinics, but a subsequent order did address the issue and put it in the category of other healthcare facilities, dental offices and whatnot. The thing you have to recognize is that this particular executive order addresses the issue of preservation of personal protective gear. This executive order was not intended to strike a blow, if you will, against abortion or against any other surgical procedure. So it's for a particular limited purpose. In that sense, it doesn't say that abortions are prohibited. It says that abortions are temporarily prohibited if they are surgical because we need that equipment. That's the way that a layperson could read it. Mm-hmm. And then it moves on to define, if you will, who gets to call whether it's a medical necessity. Well, we would ordinarily believe that that's appropriate because that's what a doctor's role is. And so ethical doctors would evaluate each particular individual for the circumstance and determine, okay, this is, this is something that we don't have to do, and make that decision. I think the point that you're making is that the experience has typically been that abortion doctors have perhaps a more liberalized view of medical necessity abortion procedure than the average person. And if that's the case, then there would not be a great deal of change in terms of the effect that this particular executive order would ultimately have, given what we anticipate to happen with the abortion practitioners.
Well, after the executive order that touched on this, the medical professionals across Indiana were confused. I talked with several of them, and so 76 of them sent a letter to the governor asking for clarification, and as best I can tell, it has not been responded to. So where are we now? Are we just in this state of the practicality is that abortions will continue unabated during this time, even though in the executive order it says they're banned? Are we just kind of waiting for the end of this now?
I don't see that there's been any change in the actual executive order. The executive order does state that unnecessary medical procedures, surgical procedures, including abortion clinics, are prohibited during this particular period of time, and leaves it up to those providers to make that determination. It does not appear that the providers are concerned about the order. I'm not aware of any efforts to try to seek an injunction or some type of recognition of noncompliance. So it would appear that abortion clinics are operating as usual, and I don't know that there's a procedure in place that would address it in keeping with this particular executive order.
As a matter of fact, in addition to the fact that abortions continue unabated in Indiana, abortion providers, specifically Planned Parenthood of Indiana, Kentucky, have released statements saying they're in full compliance. So as far as they're concerned, it's a done deal. They are complying because they have determined that the abortion is essential, and that's the way it is. So hopefully we haven't gotten to the end of this. We'll continue to try to get clarification. I want to spend a little bit of time touching on something that is absolutely horrific to me, and that is that there are some states that have indicated, I think it was spearheaded by California, no surprise, that the federal order that bans experiments on fetal tissue from aborted babies should be lifted because that inhibits research into either a vaccine or some kind of a treatment for COVID-19. That is beyond the pale to me. I just can't wrap my mind around why this issue would come up now. It seems that there's plenty of research and other avenues that are being pursued to treat COVID-19, but to say that now we have to do experiments on aborted baby parts is just horrific to me. But you stepped forward again and led with a letter to the White House. Tell us a little bit about that.
The unfortunate circumstance that happens in this type of crisis is that it brings people out of the woodwork to address their own agenda. And in this particular instance, you have 15 states led by California, as you say, no surprise there, that chose this as an opportunity to expand on an agenda item of experimenting with fetal tissue and putting it forward in the interest, if you will, of finding a cure or a treatment for the COVID-19. There doesn't appear to be any scientific basis that would suggest that there is a stronger rationale for engaging in fetal tissue research for this process than anything that's currently being done. And we saw it as a blatant political move, much like the ACLU filing an action asking for special court rules to let people out of jail. You know, that's something that the ACLU wants to see happen all the time. So the virus comes along and let's go ahead and attach to it. Right. Well, that's what we had here. And so having reviewed the letter, we took the lead and secured a number of states along with us, conservative-minded states, to send a letter to the president, the vice president, Secretary Azar, to voice our concern over the letter that was sent by our 15 Democratic colleagues that this was an exploitation, that their letter was an exploitation of the coronavirus epidemic, an opportunity for them to advocate for the expansion of research of fetal tissue that was inappropriate. And we restated our position that we are there to promote the dignity of human life from conception to natural birth, and even during a global health crisis, and particularly with no indication, no genuine sign that there is any reason to believe that some type of fetal tissue research would even be necessary, appropriate, or helpful, let alone ethical. So it was, I think it was important for us to be on point on record in that regard. We moved rather relatively quickly, and we secured, I believe, 19 or 20 additional attorneys general within about a 48-hour period.
Well, it seems that the battle lines are being drawn among the attorneys general across the country. Some are very much with us, and others are taking a more extreme position. Have you had a response from your letter, or what do you anticipate is going to happen next?
No response yet. What I anticipate happening is the ban will remain in place. I don't see that there's any change in federal policy. As I say, the effort led by California was a bit of a Don Quixote move, tilting at windmills more as to get the position out there. And we wanted to make sure that our position was clear and known, and that the administration knew that it had support from a number of states to not fall privy to this panic sensation of trying to use the coronavirus to affect every little policy that the opposition is interested in pushing.
Well, it's hard to believe that we're out of time, General Hill. Thank you so much for being with us. And thank you again for taking the lead on so many of these issues. And again, they're not always popular positions, but I have found it to be true that you are willing to do what's right, regardless of the political fallout. So we certainly appreciate that. And of course, we still have three cases that we're waiting to see if the Supreme Court will hear. And we'll have you back real soon to update us on that. I don't anticipate anything happening right away because there's another Supreme Court case that may impact the cases that we already have before the Supreme Court. So again, thank you, thank you, thank you. We appreciate it more than we can say. Thank you on behalf of unborn boys and girls and their mothers for being a strong voice for them, not only reactively, but also proactively and looking to see what things are coming on the horizon and being willing to be the leader in addressing these things. General Hill, thanks again for your time today.
Well, thank you, Kathy. And let me say thank you to you and all of the folks that you work with. Your tireless advocacy is just absolutely astonishing to watch. And I'm very pleased to be your friend and to even be able to work with you in these efforts. So thank you very much for all you do.
If you're a healthcare provider who would like to add your name to the letter asking Governor Holcomb to ban abortions during the COVID-19 crisis, please email your name, title, and city to Christina@applog.org. That's AAPLOG.org.
If you or someone you know is in a crisis pregnancy, help is just a phone call away. Call 877-791-5475. If you or someone you know is dealing with grief and pain after an abortion decision, whether you had an abortion, convinced someone else to have an abortion, or even participated in a procedure, call 877-791-5475. You'll be referred to a pregnancy resource center in your area, a place where free and confidential services are available. That's 877-791-5475. 877-791-5475.
April is National Volunteer Month, and the pro-life movement thrives on volunteers, from legislative efforts to educational programs to pregnancy centers and more. Thanks to all of you who donate your time so that others may live.
You've been listening to I Choose Life News and Views. If you have questions about this program or if you'd like to support the fight for life, please call 260-471-1849 or go to ichooselife.org, because without the right to life, no other rights matter.